And slowly fade in. Welcome to the March Madness edition of Freightonomics. I know everybody has got two TVs on or computer screens on as they're sitting there in their offices today. Zach Strickland, head of Freight Market Intelligence, here with you. Tony Mulvey, head of something.
senior analyst.
Senior analyst, whatever it is. It's good to have you here, and it's good to have everybody here as well. If you're listening to this on a recording, which probably is more likely this week.
This week. Yeah, well, especially, 12 o'clock, first game's what, 12:15?
So. Yeah, they got a few minutes.
Get some insights in there before you all your productivity away.
Yeah, the first 15 minutes. So, anyway, let's get right into it, Tony. March Madness is a funny thing, too, how it kind of economically hits the productivity.
It really
does. It really does. There's studies on it. But it doesn't really mess with the freight market too much, traditionally. No. Trucks move, and transportation tends to have to happen in March. March tends to be more of a kind of that first push month. Mm-hmm. We haven't really seen that so far, but sort of in a way. I guess we can go ahead and give people their update.
Yeah. So here, Zach, if you're ready for your market in two, we'll count it down with 3, 2, 1.
All right. So I'm going to lead off with spot rates, though, because this is what moves the needle for a lot of people out there. NTIL, the National Truckload Index, excluding estimated fuel costs total, upward movement in March. And this feels more like a bounce than anything that's significant. I did a little back end work here. Looks like a large portion of the increase is a little bit more unmixing and irregular freight movement. This time of year, we do tend to see things kind of come out of their hibernation. We see some different freight volumes coming out. Networks tend to have to adjust to that. You're talking about like Texas to North Dakota, Ontario going into Wyoming, like some just random stuff going on here that creates a little bit of nuance and stability in the market. And I think that's what's occurring here. You can see that it is kind of hump-shaped in the NTIL. So I'm not thinking that the market is going, this is not a turn. And if you really draw the line out, we're still a slow upward move with spot rates in general, but I think we're still just crawling along the floor here. Let's move into the next chart, which is going to be the contract market versus the spot market. Contract rates in white. The spot rates there in yellowish, I guess. It looks like we're just in this holding pattern. Like we are, contract rates of, yes, they're still kind of crawling lower. Spot rates are up versus last year a little bit. But it's just not, we're not seeing a strong upward trajectory or anything like that. If you were to draw a regression line, though, by the end of the year, both of these should be higher. Let's go to the next one here. OTVI, demand side, you see that little bump in March? Yes, we did have a little bit of demand bump. Nobody can tell, though, because there's still dramatic amounts of oversupply. We are absolutely in a holding pattern for volume, but volume is relatively strong if you look at that white line there so far. Let's go to the last chart. This is the thing that matters. Carrier details, net changes in operating authorities. Still down overall year over year, but we've got a little slight uptick to start the month of March, which I'm kind of like, what?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because that chart, even if you go back to 2018, awful year, right? Mm-hmm. Record number of bankruptcies probably outside of 2023. It was at the time. How's that? It was, the net change was positive for much of that year.
Yeah, this bias is high.
Yeah.
We talked about it. It's operating authorities don't clean quickly.
No.
They're not an immediate reactor when they exit. They are a strong reactor when they enter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like people will be very on top of applying for their operating authorities.
Yeah.
They will not be on top of removing their operating authorities.
Yeah. It almost goes to the point that January was almost abnormally strong, mm-hmm. To some degree. You saw what, upward movement in spot rates during kind of in the back half of January into early February. And it was like, it's probably a reaction to some of that thinking, okay, there's some stability. The market's maybe not as bad as we thought it was or as soft as we thought it was, that it's starting to move in this direction we want to get in now. So to ride the wave up, but the market has kind of shown that that was an anomaly and not the at least a short-term anomaly, right? And and it's going to take a lot longer for that upswing to actually occur.
Yeah, let's pull that chart back up, the net changes in operating authorities, because I feel like I need to explain what it is. This is basically total operating authority up or down swings. It includes the revocations as well as the new entrants. Very heavily biased towards growth. So that period of detraction in red that you see there, where we're seeing massive amounts of exits, that's extremely rare. And like Tony said, 2019, a very depressed freight market, didn't really dip down low. And that's due to the nature of just revocations and how that works. And it's very small carrier centric in terms of the volume that goes into this. The thing that concerns me here isn't the total numbers or anything like that. It's the directional shift.
Yeah.
And we've got a little bit of background work going on right now with this data that we're looking into to see if, you know, Thomas Wasson brought this up, like, can we see what type of freight these people can haul? And there is a little piece of the application form that tells us in general, some of the stuff can be a little bit more refrigerated centric and flatbed centric. And I looked into it a little bit with some of our data scientists, John Ellis, thank you so much. And it looks like so far this year, and this is not complete, we're seeing about maybe 50% of the new applicants so far this year have been in the general commodity dry van sector, where the rest of them has been like bulk, flat, refrigerated, intermodal. So that's actually a decent shift. So these entrants do appear, and again, I iterate, this is not a complete study just yet, but it looks like a lot of these new entrants that are coming in right now are a little bit skewed towards the sectors that aren't necessarily as...
They're more niche in design, right? It's running a flatbed operation is more complicated than running just your general dry van freight. And I think maybe some of that is you've seen housing starts in February were really strong. You saw increased flatbed activity. I mean, those rejection rates went crazy. I mean, they're still elevated right now. I mean, they're still remarkably high relative to what you would consider maybe normal, not COVID levels, but still. And I wonder if some of this is, you saw a lot of carriers kind of leave the umbrella and go be owner operators through the market cycle on the, but if they had, were a company driver now with a flatbed, maybe now they're making that switch and say, no, I can go do this myself.
Yeah.
Because that market is still, you have industrial productions, not soft. I mean, it's not great, but it's not terrible. But you have things backing it, right? The stimulus from infrastructure.
The industrial sector.
Like that, there's this long tail.
We are all bullish on the industrial sector.
Yeah. And I think that might be a reason why you see this kind of shift or starting to see maybe a shift. It's they know that that opportunity is going to be there and might as well get in. Like, arguably, it's relatively cheap. I mean, you look at, if you want to go buy a used truck, it's fairly inexpensive right
now. That's
true. So like, you're back at to a period where it is advantageous maybe to get into the more niche markets as opposed to the general freight dry-van market.
Truth. And we've already seen kind of those canary in the coal mine moments. Yeah. Refrigerated last fall, rejection rates really spiked up in January or in August, September last year, Pacific Northwest of places. The produce runs up there, hops and all the harvests that go on really were underserved. And the refrigerated, much more niche, underserved than general commodity van is. And flatbed, I know we've talked about it before, but flatbed really didn't get the attention that the other two got during the pandemic. It was very slow. If you look at the rejection rates for flatbed,
it took like a year difference before they started moving higher.
Yeah.
Like, 9 months to a year before they've started moving higher. But it's also project rate a lot of the time. So it's not as regular, not as scheduled. So I think that goes into it, that it's when you... through that pandemic, everybody was moving all the other stuff and kind of it got forgotten that like, and then it was like, oh, we need to move, like this stuff has to happen. It's like, oh, well, we have some pricing power now. And they didn't, it's almost like they didn't realize that they had it until
late.
Really late.
Yeah. And again, like the flatbed side is way more opaque. And also, it's not the same job. Yeah. Like when you're talking about hauling flatbed, you got a tarp, you got all the straps and everything you got to do. It is work. Manual labor.
Yeah.
Not that it's not for the dry van and refrigerated side, but it's definitely scale up.
Yeah.
In terms of physical activity. So definitely going to be something to watch moving forward. I don't know that I'm like super concerned about the carrier details, net changes being flat right now. Again, like we said, it skews higher. So it's still in retraction. Supply is still coming down overall. Not that much, you know, not a thing there that shifted, but it is interesting to see some of this nuance and these data points. So moving on to the economy a little bit, we had a huge meeting. I don't know if you call it huge. I don't want to be hyperbolic here. The Fed basically said, we're going to hold again, holding pattern. It's like we just keep kind of like saying, let's just wait and see. I don't think that's the worst decision.
No, I don't either, because I mean, you got CPI last week before. I mean, it came in hotter than expected. Obviously, the Fed, I mean, that is the index that the Fed doesn't use to gauge inflation. They use the PCE, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, but it's gone up. And like the whole reason you raise interest rates, even though we could go in on long tangents about how it probably doesn't really matter in the long run to prices, but the reason they raised interest rates was to cool inflation by effectively deterring demand. And that's what they say.
That's their overt messaging. Yeah. And we all know that that's not 100% truth, mm-hmm. because it takes forever for that to filter into the consumer.
Yeah.
You and I don't stop buying stuff because interest rates went up.
Yeah.
Some of these larger purchases, yes, it influences house purchasing and things like that. But it really didn't like slow it that much.
It hasn't. And part of that is the supply side of the housing market, right? It's an undersupplied market. And then you factor in that people have locked in interest rates at sub 3% mortgage rates. They're not going to go out and buy a new house.
Well, we stopped people from moving as much.
Well, that and asset prices haven't been repriced lower dramatically.
No.
And that's typically what you would see, right? You raise interest rates, it depresses asset prices. And that hasn't really happened. Like asset prices have held relatively stable and interest rates have gone up. And it sets up that once they go down, that prices will boom.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting dynamic, actually, when you think about it.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated. Yeah. But what it signals is that, hey, the economy is not in a place. Like, they're saying it's growing rather healthily and pretty strong. But you start looking at other factors. Inflation's clearly not going away. It's mm-hmm. still, I mean, it was higher than expectations. It's still up, 3.2% year over year versus the long-term target of 2%, and we started moving, it was 3.1 last month, so it's moved up and not continue this downward move. So it just doesn't set up for one interest rate cut yet, even though they're still pricing in three cuts before the end of the year. But then there's a whole labor situation that's kind of going on in the back end that it's like, is the economy as strong as people perceive?
We are still catching up and moving out of this pandemic bubble type environment. Things are still trying to churn and figure out where is the place that we need to be. This CPI at an aggregate level, I don't even know if I can take anything away from it at this point, because it's so mixed with all these different things. Used to move somewhat in sync back before the pandemic. Now you've got one sector's way up, one sector's way down. You mix those together and you get this, you know, mm-hmm. it's insurance costs out of control.
Rent or shelter prices driven primarily by rent.
Yeah.
Way up. Energy prices changed dramatically. Yeah. Food prices. I mean, we can exclude those and call core, but I mean, it's same idea. It's shelter basically runs the entire CPI. It's crazy. It's like 90% of core inflation is shelter prices. They're up 7%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of that is it's so lagged. I mean, it's like a year behind everything else. So, but still, it's to the Fed's fight, or the fight that they're having, is proving more challenging than maybe they thought it would be when they started delivering messages a couple months ago.
The Fed doesn't control what a company does in terms of setting prices. Like, we're in a free market environment where I go to the store, and if I'm willing to pay it, willingness to pay, that is what matters. That's what drives the CPI.
Yeah.
If I'm willing to pay a certain amount, if you gave me a 2% increase on cornflakes, and I probably don't even notice.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, at that point, you're talking about pennies.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, now, cereal.
Yeah.
If we could go, I mean, it was, what, $4 for a box of cereal pre-pandemic, and now it's, what, $7, $8? Mm-hmm. It's noticeable, but it hasn't really deterred spending decisions. Yeah. Now, retailers are saying that consumers are searching for value, but it doesn't mean that they're not still buying some of the
same. Everyone increases their brand of cereal at the same time and the same level,
you end up buying the same stuff.
You end up doing it. And it really what matters, like, I think we've created also this very polarizing world where you have, you know, the upper echelon of spenders haven't really been impacted by any of this. They're still spending at the same levels and they're feeling the same things that they felt. Whereas the lower tier individuals have certainly been trading down.
Yeah, they have. But what's interesting is they're still in aggregate spending more than what they were. If you look at like credit and debit card spending trends, like those are still higher year over year, which means they're not adjusted for pricing or inflation. So when you see that number, that real value, that increase, it indicates that they're still spending more money than what is in their pocket because prices have gone up to a level, even if they're trading down, they're still having to spend more than what they were a year ago.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting dynamic is like you haven't really seen these like major just hit the brake spending trend. Yeah. Like,
But the debt levels are increasing. I saw a chart the other day where it showed the chart of the credit card level. I should have pulled that in here. The average interest rate for credit cards.
It's crazy. It's like
25%.
Yeah.
Something like that. It's like right below it if it's not right on it. And that's the problem with credit card interest rates are that doesn't materialize for a consumer until later.
Yeah.
Until that minimum payment per month actually becomes something because 25 becomes 50, becomes 100.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the percent, if you're just paying minimum.
Yeah.
You're maintaining your balance.
It doesn't change.
At an extremely high level. And if you're going to throw more on it, which is what the data suggests, they're...
Yeah, I mean, the total outstanding revolving credit in January was up 0.6% month over month. I mean, it's like at $1.3 trillion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that number just keeps going up. There's no stopping it, right? The only time it gets stopped or slowed down, really, it's actually accelerating from where it was, the trend line it was on pre-pandemic. The only time was when stimulus happened, people took that money and paid down balances on their credit card. But the problem is when you do that, the key is don't go run the balance right back up. And the key, and what's happened is they have run that back,
right
back up.
It's psychology. It is basic psychology. We have trained our population to spend, and that's what they're doing. And so that's my only looming threat looking forward. So far, everything is okay. Like they're not sounding any alarms. We shouldn't sound any alarms on anything just yet. You can go in just like every economist everywhere can go and find reasons to say there's going to be a recession. There's going to be a bullish market, et cetera. There's too many mixed signals right now to think really make a solid rational conclusion. Let's move into the freight environment here. We've got some stories that I think are absolutely worth noting. That help us kind of understand the, you know, future state of things, state of freight, if you will. Tune in today at 2 for those of you that are around for me and Craig to talk about, Craig and I to talk about the state of freight there. But this first story that I want to talk about is Borderlands. Noe Mahoney does a fantastic job. I always watch for an article coming out of his little section here on freightways.com. Mexico container shipments from China to Mexico skyrocketed in January. So purpose of this article, and I know I've gotten so many questions around Mexico and Mexico data, et cetera. I want to pull up a chart here, the China to Mexico IOTI. So imports, and this is the point of the article. These type of charts terrify me because they're very quick movers, very volatile. Last year, 2023, there's like a 40% increase And I think the Zenetta data that they use, NOAA uses here, is like 60% mm-hmm. increase. This measures bookings at 20-foot equivalents. They use a different denominator. Doesn't matter. Point being, volumes from China to Mexico are skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically the theory that Peter Sand, you know, Zenetta analyst wrote was that a lot of this is just simply bypassing tariffs.
Yeah.
And so two things here. One, Mexico is growing in terms of nearshoring, industrial activity, et cetera. That's expected. That's a slow roll.
Yeah.
This is like...
very quick.
Very quick, especially if it's consumer goods centric. I do think there's a lot of raw material going on here, yeah. too. So we can't tell if it's raw goods upstream or downstream, but it looks like, and based on Peter Sand's analysis, there's a good bit of consumer goods and finished goods that are going into Mexico right now that are going to cross the border.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sets up Laredo, El Paso, mm-hmm. all the border markets really to be strong. And I think it's been talked about, right? Mexico became the number one trade partner for the U.S. This is why.
Yeah.
Because the goods went from instead of going China to the U.S. directly, they're going around it, whether it's up through Canada or into Mexico, and then they're just coming across the border because just it makes sense, mm-hmm. for one. But like you said...
well,
Laredo tariffs.
Yeah, Laredo, the second largest growth market in the United States.
Yeah.
Over the last 2 years, second to only Phoenix, which has California influence as well, yeah. as Mexico.
Yeah.
The next story I want to hit on real quickly. Please go check out BrightWays.com. These articles are the ones that I would read if I were anybody out in the world. The next one, DOT confirms boost in West Coast container imports. John Gallagher, of course, covering this story about how basically saying that the U.S. DOTs are admitting that there has been some shift back to the West Coast. Anybody that reads Freight Waves or listens to our show knows that already.
Yeah.
It's not news. But I think the point of this story is we are in the same boat that we were prior to COVID in terms of overall risk to infrastructure.
Yeah.
If something were to shift dramatically, West Coast ports are exposed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then you factor in that right now there's the ongoing labor negotiations on the East Coast that just add to this. So it's one of those things that's, it's funny. I know JP Hampstead wrote an article recently about the CEO for Hapag-Lloyd talking about an earlier peak season. I mean, talking about peak season, like, pulling forward, yeah. to avoid any possible disruption to the East Coast, because the West Coast might not be an option because they're dealing with the whole thing now, right? So like, it's like we might be back into a situation where congestion on the West Coast piles up because Red Sea, Suez Canal, kind of, and then Panama Canal, the issues that continue there shift things now back to the West, mm-hmm. Coast. And then if you have labor issues that go all the way down through Texas, mm-hmm. right? And the whole eastern half of the country, like, a disruption there, I mean, it just puts even more pressure on the West Coast, which, I mean, really, when you think about it, would be probably good for the overall freight economy to some degree, because it's just going to pull, capacity's going to flood there. East Coast is going to be starved, but there has to be demand on that side too. Like, that's the give
anybody,
and take.
Anybody that has gone back to their old way of living, targeting cost controls, targeting a single point of failure on the West Coast, the supply chain habits that were in 2019, mm-hmm. Largely, you have to take a strong look at your situation.
Yeah.
How hedged are you if something were to shift dramatically? Because we are setting up for the exact same,
yeah.
things that occurred in the pandemic. Now, probably at a much lower scale.
Yeah.
You don't see demand,
yeah, you don't have demand.
60% overnight, yeah. like we had there. But certainly some level of, we've all gotten accustomed to this very easy sourcing environment. Mm-hmm. If you have rates that are 20% below market value, you're celebrating success today. You're saying, man, this is great.
But that's going to be 40% above market when something breaks.
Like near term versus long term.
Yeah.
You need to think, like last year, you could totally grab all that cash, get away with it. You had, yeah. a long road ahead of you. This year, if you are targeting cost alone, you are setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah. This has been a theme that, I don't know, I've tried to hit on, is that if you're not preparing, and even we talked about it last year, if you're not preparing for the upswing at the end of last year, you're going to miss, like, your reward, your risk is much higher than the potential reward because you already clawed back a lot of that cost.
We saw the same thing in 2017. You're going to be like, Zach, no, it's not the same market. No, it's not the same market, but it's the same mechanism. We're having a deteriorating supply environment much faster.
Yeah.
Hard to turn that engine around with a pretty strong demand side environment.
Yeah.
All it's going to take is once those get closer together, we're still far away from it. A hurricane,
anything.
Like nobody ever foresees these events.
Yeah.
But those are the things that tip the scale.
Yeah. And once they start and it cripples it, it's we saw in the pandemic, it's very hard to fix it very quickly.
Oh, you're already out.
Yeah.
You're already out. Those 20% cost savings become 60% loss.
Absolutely.
All right. Enjoy the tourney.